This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Neil Conan. Dust is the inconsequential substance you shake off your heels on the way out of town. It's the stuff of the elusive bunnies beneath our couches and the accusatory material that gathers atop the stationary bikes we bought with the best of intentions. Let's be honest, most of us don't think about dust a lot. Now, a new book argues that dust is the alpha and the omega, the origin of life and our inevitable fate. The book is called The Secret Life of Dust, From the Cosmos to the Kitchen Counter, The Big Consequences of Little Things. Author Hannah Holmes joins us from Portland, Maine. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much, Neil.
Well, everything in your book comes back to dust, including the origins of our planet.
It's pretty wonderful, isn't it? I had no idea when I started that, well, it all did begin with dust. And billions of years ago, really the first dust coalesced to form our solar system. Without dust forming clumps in space, there would be no circumstance under which a solar system could form. Space is just too violent. But dust acts as a little womb, and it protects the things in its innards from the violent radiation in space and allows dust and gas to slow down and cool down and compress itself into things like stars and planets. And that's where we came from.
Is that stardust the same as the dust that's hiding beneath my bed right now?
There is some of that stardust beneath your bed right now, which is one of the things I find most endearing about house dust, is there's all kinds of really cool stuff in it, including dinosaur bones and bits of dead people from thousands of years ago, and yes, space dust. Space dust is still floating around in our solar system and throughout the cosmos. It comes to Earth in huge quantities. Every day there is space dust fluttering down onto the Earth, and it certainly does get into your house. One astronomy professor told me, we eat it.
And I have to say, I was astounded by the volume of dust that your scientists that you talked to found floating in the air, indeed rivers of dust that circle the planet.
That is a rather recent revelation, in part brought to us by NASA satellites, which have allowed scientists to really see from space the huge scale of these dust storms that come out of the world's big deserts. When an enormous dust storm comes out of the Sahara or the Gobi Desert, it blows a river of dust that is pale gold, and it swirls across the ocean. It looks like a yellow river flowing over a blue background. It's astonishing how thick it is and how long these rivers can go. They can flow for thousands of miles across the ocean.
Tell us the story of how bauxite, the stuff from which we get aluminum, how bauxite got to Jamaica.
There were some scientists who noticed a little mismatch in the soils of some Caribbean islands a few years ago. The actual rocks there tend to be gray coral stone, the skeletons of old coral.
That's how the island's built up.
Right. But on top of that sort of dead gray stone, there are beautiful red soils. And people began to wonder, how do you get a red soil from a gray rock? When they looked more closely, they found the geochemical signature of Saharan dust in this red soil, and were forced to conclude that the soil blew across the Atlantic Ocean and fell on these islands. Not in one big flight, mind you, but over millions of years. And when they got thinking about it, they found that the bauxite mines on Jamaica bear a bit of a resemblance to that same dust. They haven't done the same conclusive testing that they've done in Barbados. But it stands to reason. You have enormous concentrations of aluminum in the bauxite mines, and the Saharan dust is enriched in aluminum, and there's no real good source of aluminum on Jamaica itself. So that aluminum did come from somewhere else, and the only logical explanation is it came from the Sahara.
And that is an awful lot of aluminum dust that's blowing over there.
You have to really stop and think about how many tons of dust we're talking about. One estimate is that the Sahara throws up 1 billion tons of dust a year. A billion tons. That would actually fill boxcars that would wrap around the equator something like 8 times. It's a huge amount of dust, and that's 1 year. You can multiply that by millions of years, and yeah, you can start to get some aluminum cans building up there.
With all that dust in the atmosphere, is there any such thing as fresh air?
There is absolutely not. The cleanest air on the planet, as the book mentions, might put about 25,000 pieces of dust inside a juice glass sitting on the railing of a porch. There is no clean air. Fortunately, some of those clean places have more or less clean dust, meaning it's more natural than industrial.
Now, you live in Portland, Maine. Describe for us the kind of dust that you would typically experience if you went down to the beach there in Portland.
There's an enormous amount of salt dust that comes off the oceans. It blows up when white caps break. So there would be a lot of dust, salt dust hanging in the air and blowing around. It gives that wonderful smell.
Mm-hmm.
There might be some little blobs of pinene. That's a chemical shed by pine trees that tends to form little balls that float around in the air. You might also encounter some bits of dried up otter dung, perhaps.
Ugh.
It's a sad fact that every single thing on Earth is falling apart, and you are breathing it.
And these engines, these rivers of dust that you talked about before, they're manipulated by weather systems and other things, but a dust storm out of the Gobi Desert you describe reaching the west coast of the United States, what, 4 days later?
Yeah. When dust gets up high in the atmosphere, there are very strong winds up there, and they can transport the dust very fast. And, Trans-Pacific crossing in 4 days is pretty impressive. And it means that you get a very high concentration of dust arriving in Seattle. Quite a surprise to scientists there to find thick Gobi Desert dust hanging around the neighborhood.
Have scientists yet figured out, with all of this dust in the atmosphere that they hadn't really thought about before, have they figured out what it's contributing to the arguments over global warming, for example?
One thing that they're perhaps starting to understand is that they way underestimated this little character. And in truth, there are a variety of characters because dust is a bit of everything. So desert dust, they're starting to draw some conclusions because it's pale colored. It can reflect some sunlight, which should give you a cooling effect.
Mm-hmm.
But because it is a little rock, it absorbs some heat from the sun and actually heats up the atmosphere. Now, the net effect of those things, who knows at this point. Another kind of dust that's getting an awful lot of study right now is soot, because again, scientists A, didn't know how much is up there, still working on that as well, and B, don't know what it does up there. Increasingly, they're realizing it's a terrific absorber of heat, just as black tarmac is down on the surface of the Earth. You have hundreds of thousands of little black rocks up there in the sky, and they also absorb an enormous amount of heat. What happens as a result of that? One effect is that it can foil the formation of clouds. Because it changes the temperature in the atmosphere, it can halt the circulation of moisture from the surface of the Earth up into the atmosphere. If you don't have moisture in the atmosphere, you don't have clouds. And clouds are a very powerful cooling force in our planetary system.
Because they block the sunlight.
Right, they reflect a huge amount of sunlight. So kill off the clouds and you end up with a warmer planet.
I was fascinated by the idea that each dust, each desert, for example, has its own unique signature.
Yes, and when scientists find dust in some strange place, like trapped in a Greenland glacier, they can isolate that dust that has fallen over thousands of years. They can take its chemical fingerprint, so to speak, and then they can go looking around the world to see where it came from. They can compare it to dusts from the Sahara, from the Taklamakan Desert, from the Kizilkum Desert, from the Gobi, and they can find another fingerprint that matches and conclude that the wind goes from point A to point B and drops that dust.
So it tells you a lot about the wind patterns that were evident whenever that dust fell, and there are other ways to measure that.
Yes, they can also get information about ancient winds from the size of the dust, because if the wind is stronger, it's going to pick up bigger dust, and the dust you see in a glacier will vary in size with time. And the reason scientists care about this is that it helps them to reconstruct the climate during the last ice age, which was a rather dusty period. So they can use dust trapped in glaciers to paint a picture of how strong the winds were, where they blew from, long, long ago.
Several times, in several different places in your book, on issues ranging from the climate to medicine, you write that, you know, scientists didn't take dust seriously until very recently, and because, and the reasons vary. Why do you think it was that science seemingly ignored this stuff?
I think different reasons in different cases. It was hard to conceive of how much dust was in the air until scientists could look down on it from above in some senses. And satellite photography has blown that picture up large. It's impossible to ignore the huge quantities of dust that are in the air. And once you realize that's the case, then you have to ask, how is that affecting the climate? How does it affect the weather? Those are enormously important questions in science right now.
My guest is Hannah Holmes. Her book is The Secret Life of Dust. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Now more with Hannah Holmes, author of The Secret Life of Dust, a book which covers everything from blowing sand to the carcinogenic mutagens we cook up in our kitchens.
More recently, human life has gotten very complicated from a chemical standpoint, and we add all sorts of things to our house dust, including all the stuff that we cook. That stuff flies up into the air in enormous quantities. Before you can see smoke from what you're cooking, you're already breathing a huge amount of whatever it is.
There was one example you gave of, I think it was women in China, who apparently suffer, I think, lung cancer at the same rate as American women, but women in China don't typically smoke.
Yeah, they seem to typically, well, the high-risk population seems to typically fry their food, and they fry in a particularly dangerous kind of oil that we don't use here. And that burning oil enters their lungs and gives them lung cancer. That's how it appears.
In our Western houses, part of the problem, your scientists say, is that our houses are also too tight.
Yes, we're really stewing ourselves in our dust these days. I think when we lived in caves, we had a lot more air exchange in a given day, and we had less sophisticated dusts. Now we have all manner of dusts. Everything that we introduce to our lives and our houses ends up in our house dust, and then we keep it locked in there for hours and hours.
And as we walk around our houses, you describe that each of us carries with us a personal cloud of dust.
That's sweet, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's your own personal cloud, and anyone who gets near you breathes your personal cloud. It's got a lot of skin flakes in it, because we shed millions of those. A lot of skin flakes that one scientist described to me as floating around you in a chimney effect, going off the top of your head in a little fountain. Lots of skin flakes. Lots of bits of your clothing. Every time you move, tiny microscopic shreds of your clothing are rubbed off your clothes, and those hang around you. But a lot of the personal cloud is still a bit of a mystery to scientists who do actually study this. It seems to be that everything you do in your day collects on your clothing, or it collects on your clothing when it's hanging in the closet. And then as you walk around, there's sort of a pig pen effect where you're just followed by the dusts of your entire life.
The skin that erupts off our heads in these fountains falls to our carpets, where it is devoured by some of the most truly frightening creatures on the planet, the dust mites.
Oh, what could be frightening about a creature that doesn't even have a head? What could be less threatening than an animal with no head? This is like a little deflated balloon with little pointy legs, and it exists just to clean up after us.
I have to say that I'm terrified of dust mites, particularly the idea that they're on the bed with me.
But you can't see them. I've actually looked since I know they're there. I thought maybe I could see them, but they're a little too small. If you had super shiny black sheets, then there's a possibility you could see the tiny cream-colored things moving around. But the other problem here with this sort of wildlife viewing is that they're shy, and they tend to hide on the other side of the sheet from the one that you are on.
Good.
They're still there.
They are hunted, however, by predators, including the rather nasty-sounding pseudoscorpion.
Yeah, there's a wild Serengeti in your house dust. No kidding. The dust mites eat the skin, and they are in turn stalked and killed by the predatory mites that leap out from the carpet and kill them and suck them dry.
This unseen battle that goes on in our carpets, what's the effect of it?
One of the effects is that they do an awful lot of pooping, and an awful lot of people are terribly allergic to that particular protein that's found in the dust mite manure. This tends to get very concentrated in houses, especially if they're not vacuumed regularly. It tends to be concentrated in the sofa cushions, actually, most of all, and beside the bed. So that's one result of having this little zoo in our houses. But another result is just that nature comes in with us. There's no shutting nature out, and we live in an ecosystem and we produce an ecosystem. These animals are just an extension of the outdoor world.
Now that we know of all of these creatures, whether they're lovable or terrifying depends on your point of view, I guess, but now that we know about them, what can you do about them? Is there a way to get your house clean?
Well, the experts would say three things. Number one, take your shoes off when you come indoors. That brings in a huge amount of dirt and all sorts of other unpleasant things, too, like pesticides and lead. As much as half the lead dust in your house is not from your windowsills, it's from your feet, from walking around outside. Another thing that's incredibly important is to use a good doormat. One of those vinyl-backed numbers like they have in department stores are really effective. But vacuuming is also extremely important, and many vacuum cleaners don't do the greatest job. The experts recommend a model that has a little light that goes on when it has sucked up as much dust as it can. Then, if you're talking about dust mites, the most effective thing is probably just to wrap up your pillows and your mattresses in those anti-allergy container things.
And that's about all you can do.
Well, vacuum, vacuum, vacuum. And the lower you can keep the humidity in your house, the less happy your dust mites are going to be. That's difficult to do unless you live in a desert, but it can be done. You can buy a humidifier that keeps the humidity low.
And I guess the reference that most of us know about dust is, well, first the ashes to ashes part, and then dust thou art, and unto dust thou shalt return.
And there will be no exceptions to that one, I'm happy to report. It gives me a bit of pleasure to think that we all are going to end up being blown out into space as little black bits of smoke. I don't know why I find that so pleasing, but perhaps it's because our solar system was built from space dust, and in the end, our human bodies are only going to enrich the dust of the cosmos. As things wind down in the solar system, our planet is most likely going to spiral in toward the sun. It's going to be engulfed in the hot outer regions of the sun and burned to a crisp. And a little bit of smoke that was us is going to waft out into the cosmos.
And I guess be recycled.
Absolutely. Over and over for the foreseeable future, which is very long, space dust will continue to come together in clumps and form solar systems. And then when those solar systems burn out, they'll produce more dust. The universe will continue to get more and more dusty with every generation of stars.
You can almost describe the story of humanity as the effort to prevent our bodies turning into dust. We all, of course, are familiar with the Egyptian mummification, and a lot of modern-day twists on that are happening right now, most of them, it seems, in California.
Yeah. Well, there are also people who really do desperately want to be dust, and they want their dust to blow around. There's some wonderful ways to get your ashes scattered these days, including being packed into firecrackers and blasted off over the ocean. But there are also folks who really resist that concept, and mummification is one of the best ways. There is a company that does it. They will mummify you and even encapsulate you in a big metal egg. And presumably that should postpone your dustification significantly.
You say the Earth is going to end up as nothing more than dust, but wasn't it at least a possibility that the Earth would end up as a burned-out cinder floating through space?
Yes, there are some chances that we'll escape that dusty fate. One is that our planet will actually be adopted by another star system, and we could be sort of kidnapped and taken away by a different star system and live a much longer life with much cooler, slower-burning stars as our new parents. And there's yet another possible outcome whereby we simply fly off into the into the cosmos by ourselves and die a very cold and lonesome death.
Hannah Holmes, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Hannah Holmes' book is The Secret Life of Dust, From the Cosmos to the Kitchen Counter, The Big Consequences of Little Things. I'm Neil Conan. This is Fresh Air.